Chapter 12. It turned out that Big Blenny had a horrible sense of direction. The trail the ex-thug left took a wide, meandering path that felt like a tour of some of the Meyerwood's most treacherous terrain. The man had fled through sadistic briar bushes, a sucking swamp, and a thicket of bladewood trees on his last run, only to meet his end no more than 100 yards from where he started. Katha and the heroes followed his trail to a small camp by the mouth of a cave just off the main road. Gorm kicked a charred iron cookpot off the ashes of a dead fire. A faint warmth still radiated from the deepest embers.
"Ain't been more than a day," he said. "Whatever happened, it happened last night."
"Whatever it was, I'm glad I missed it," said Heraldin. The ground outside the cave had been tilled and churned and liberally sprinkled with blood and debris by some great battle.
"Something's not right here," said Katha, joining them.
"Well, grass shouldn't be red, for starters," said Heraldin.
"Yes, thank you, Heraldin."
Niln's skin had a green pallor.
"There's that. But where are the bodies?" said Katha. "What kind of fight leaves a battlefield looking this way and doesn't leave a single casualty?"
"Or at least doesn't leave 'em behind," said Gorm. "Something could have ate 'em, or dragged them away."
"No," said Katha. "There's no sign the corpses were dragged, and I don't see any tracks big enough for a predator that large."
"Well, the bodies didn't just walk away," said Heraldin.
"Unless they did," said Katha.
There was an unpleasant pause while they collectively shuddered at the implications.
"Bloody necromancy," said Heraldin.
The line between necromancy and noctomancy was ill-defined and fuzzy, but walking corpses were a good indicator that some wizard or mage had violated the Order of the Moon's strict rules against the magic of undeath. Individually, a walking skeleton or a zombie was a nuisance, on par with a door-to-door missionary from the Temple of Apo. Both had unnatural persistence, an unnerving grin, and a single-minded focus on making converts. Fortunately, zombies and skeletons tended to be rather feeble and slow, and so the odd undead was easy to get rid of, certainly easier than door-to-door priests. The problem was that every couple of decades or so, some wizard would notice that controlling people was enjoyable, and that controlling dead people was easy, and a kind of twisted algebra would lead him down a dark path. Given time, privacy, and a supply of cold bodies, a necromancer could raise a small army to rival that of the kings and queens of the Freedlands. The Heroes Guild usually sent the best of the best to deal with such insurrections. Inexperienced parties didn't fare well against the rotting armies of a dark wizard, and a hero lost to the undead was a foe gained.
"What's the best way to deal with a necromancer?" said Niln.
"You have to wait for the right moment to approach him," said Heraldin.
"How do you know the right moment?"
"It's any time after someone else has chopped the morbid bastard's head off," said Heraldin. "We don't want any part of this."
"If there is a necromancer threatening the countryside, we can't just leave," Niln said.
"And we ain't just leaving," Gorm interrupted. "We're also searching the area, and if the gods have any kindness, we're also finding them thrice-cursed orc statues. And then we're leaving."
"But think of what a necromancer could do to people around here."
"I will think about it, and then I'll write it down, and I'll put it in our reports to the guild, and then they'll deal with any overactive skeletons," said Gorm. "Not us. We're on a job."
Gorm wanted to remind the High Scribe that if he couldn't manage to stay on his feet after looking at the remains of Big Blenny, he wasn't going to do anything to a horde of zombies beyond ensuring that they were well fed. But you couldn't say as much to someone who believed in destiny. Lots of heroes started out like Niln, wide-eyed children who thought they knew the end to their story and just assumed that the middle would sort itself out. They all learned one way or another that life's tale doesn't work that way. Many only learned as much when they met their end in an unfortunate plot twist.
"What if fighting the necromancer means the elven marbles get whisked away while we're busy?" Gorm said, switching tactics. "What would the king say? Or what if someone else owns the looting rights to the necromancer, and another party of heroes is on the way? We don't know the whole picture, lad. We only have a hint of a piece of it. So we stick to the job."
"It just doesn't feel right," said Niln. "It's not heroic."
"No, it's professional," said Gorm. "We'll be sure to report that there may be a necromancer running about when we get back to a city."
Niln sighed.
"Very well. Hey, you may want to see this," Laruna called to them, waving from the mouth of the cave.
The Solomancer and Jin had searched a shallow cleft in the granite outcropping. A fine mist hovered around several huge slabs of ice a few yards inside the mouth of the cave. Jin was sorting through shards and packing that was scattered around several broken wooden crates. One of the box's sides was stamped with the words, Relic Investment Group.
Relic Investments? That sounds familiar, said Gorm.
Isn't that the company that took the marbles? Said Niln.
He rooted through his backpack and pulled out the maroon file Johan had given them.
Yes, Relic Investments was transporting the elven marbles from Scoria to Andoran.
So this could be the crate containing the marbles, said Gorm.
Could have been, corrected Jin. Now it's more a pile of debris with some packing under it. And this as well.
Jin pressed a necklace into Gorm's hand. It was a string of wispy, scratchy twine threaded through colored beads and small yellowing pearls, pearls with sharp edges and small roots, pearls that didn't actually look much like pearls once Gorm examined them closely.
Teeth, he said.
Your squire found them behind the ice, said Jin.
The Shabza!
Jewelry made from teeth is a common practice among the orcs, said Jin.
And we know that the orcs have been after the elven marbles, said Laruna. They must have gotten the elves' intelligence as well, and come in to take them.
But what about the necromancer? Said Niln.
Necromancer? Said Jin.
We found evidence of the undead, said Caitha.
What would the undead want with the stones? Said Laruna. They don't show much interest in anything they can't eat.
Why would orcs drag away the corpses? Said Heraldin.
Caitha shook her head. Nobody dragged away any corpses.
The orcs could be the necromancer, suggested Niln.
Or the undead, said Heraldin.
Gorm rubbed his temples. The problem with the professional heroics industry, he had often said over one too many beers, was the title. The fame and the glory, and even the very word hero, had a way of going straight to people's heads and convincing them there was more to their job than violence and wealth retrieval. Overconfident heroes often tried to act as army commanders or diplomats, or, as in this case, detectives. He watched the rest of his party wrestle with the clues like a litter of kittens attempting to take on a loom. They reviewed evidence and discussed possible scenarios as though they were town guards and thief catchers, rather than a team of hired killers specializing in monster removal. He looked over and saw that Geist was watching him. The weapons master tilted his head toward the arguing heroes, and then gave Gorm a nod that summed up the dwarf's thoughts quite succinctly.
Aye, said Gorm. Amateurs.
Geist nodded and resumed watching the squabble. When they started discussing the possibility of thieves flying in and out of the swamp atop giant birds, Gorm couldn't hold back.
Stop overthinking this, he barked. There's a time and a place to figure out who took the marbles and why, but it ain't when the elven marbles themselves are less than a day's ride away and leaving fast. The point is to get the marbles back.
How are we to know where to find the marbles if we don't know who took them? Said Laruna.
Somebody walked out of here, right? Orcs or walking dead or a troop of mummers, but somebody carried the stones out through the woods, said Gorm.
Unless they rode away on great eagles, said Heraldin, a vocal proponent of the theory.
Shut up. If someone walked out, they left tracks. And if they left tracks, we can follow them. And if we follow them...
We could find the stones, said Caitha.
I suppose we could, said Niln.
Yes, but do we really want to go chasing after an unknown threat, said Jin.
We could face a necromancer with an undead army, said Laruna.
Or orc sky knights, suggested Heraldin.
Whoever has the marbles probably intends to keep them, said Caitha. If it's the undead or an orc horde, what then?
Gorm held up his axe.
We kill them all and let the guild sort it out.
Two things were quickly apparent when the seven heroes started tracking whomever had stolen the elven marbles again. The first was that the thieves had made for the road by the most direct route possible. There had been a good-sized group of them. Caitha thought 10 to 12 individuals creating a broad path of signs through the undergrowth straight to the dirt road that curved around the camp. The second truth was that there was no use trying to track anything on the road. The gravel path saw too much use from the swamp's denizens and was crossed by too many shallow streams. Caitha lost the trail almost immediately, and after a mile in either direction, she couldn't pick it up again.
The shadows were growing long by then, and it was a long hike back to Ebonmire. Gorm didn't like the idea of leaving the trail to grow colder than it already was, but he preferred it to a night in the Mirewood. Reluctantly, he announced that they should head back to the inn, as the road would soon become too dangerous to travel. Except that it didn't. For the entire journey back to town, Gorm didn't spot so much as a scargling. Even the murderous whip vines seemed to shrink back at their approach. There were no howls from the forest, no threatening growls, no magically empowered weasels scampering into the road. It was the kind of peace that made Gorm uneasy, quiet where there should be noise, respite that wasn't hard-earned. In his experience, it was usually the calm before the storm. The others felt it too, he saw. Gorm caught Caitha staring into the woods at times. If he didn't know better, he would have sworn she looked wistful, almost yearning for something out among the black trees. It was hard to tell, though. The elf always turned back to the task at hand whenever she noticed someone watching her. The fallout Gorm anticipated never came, and they made good time back to town. They were still on the first torch when they saw the lights of Ebonmire and the red sow through the trees. The innkeeper welcomed them back with an easy smile.
Good journey.
Unproductive, said Gorm, stamping the dirt from his boots. The other heroes filed into the tavern behind him.
And did you encounter much trouble on the road?
No, surprisingly, said Heraldin, hanging his cloak.
Ah, see? That'd be the king in the wood, said the innkeeper. Did you leave him the purple?
I suppose we forgot, said Gorm.
Oh, you'll have to leave it out on a post in town. He's taken them off the one behind the stables before.
Gorm was in no mood to settle a bill with a reclusive forest spirit that was fixated on a particular color.
Look, I—
The innkeeper's wife burst through the back door and affixed her horrible, fishy eyes on him.
You ain't paid the king,
she demanded.
Was just stepping out to do it now,
Gorm finished. Cursing superstition under his breath, he hurried out into the night. The horses whinnied and nickered as he walked around the decrepit stables. Thordon's month was well underway, and shrubs outside the inn were beginning to show hints of amber. Soon the month of Fireleaf would earn its name, setting trees alight with brilliant reds, yellows, and hues of orange. Not long after, the festival of orchids would start in the halls beneath the mountain of Khazad Im, and Gorm would be absent yet again, if he couldn't manage to find the thrice-cursed elven marbles. He thought about the campsite in the Mirewood. He'd expected bandits to be there, but instead they'd found signs of almost everyone else. What were licensed thugs doing at the bandit camp? How could the orcs have gotten wind of elven intelligence on the marble's whereabouts? And what would a necromancer want with old orc statues? Something skittered away into the shadows, and it reminded Gorm of Bert, the handbag performer who'd told him about the Leviathan project. The exact nature of the project was unclear, but it must have been the reason an evil wizard wanted the marbles. Otherwise, Dattar Ermion and his cohorts never would have stamped the project's sigil on them. Gorm placed the handful of purple baubles on an old post between the stables and the wood. As luck would have it, he knew where he could talk to someone about the Leviathan project, and talk to some orcs, and find at least one thug. All his best remaining leads pointed to Bloodroot, the orc settlement one of each Magrash had directed him to. As he passed the stables again, he was surprised to see Mr. Flynn and Brunt leading their mounts from the pens.
"What are ye doing here?"
he barked. Mr. Flynn seemed equally surprised by the encounter.
"Why, Mr. Ingerson," he said, attempting to recover with some measure of grace, "what a coincidence that we should meet here."
"Especially since you were supposed to be on business elsewhere," said Gorm. "What are you doing here?"
"I'm afraid the nature of the mercenary business means that Silver Talon assignments and the locations they take us to are highly confidential," said Flynn.
"Top secret,"
rumbled Brunt.
"Right you are, Mr. Brunt. But let us focus on the affairs we have in common. Have you found your marbles, Mr. Ingerson?"
"In the works," said Gorm.
"Ah," said Mr. Flynn. He added, with calculated casualness, "It seems your best course of action would be to return to Andoran."
"If and I didn't know better, I'd say that sounded like someone attempting to interfere with Heroes Guild business."
"Oh, certainly not. Mere speculation between professionals."
They exchanged smiles of cordial loathing.
"As a matter of curiosity, I would enjoy learning where your adventure will take you," added Mr. Flynn.
"I'm afraid the nature of professional heroics keeps our plans highly confidential," said Gorm. "And the nature of our relationship means I'd sooner knock your teeth out than tell you."
"Aha, clever. Your intimidating nature is matched only by your subtlety, Mr. Ingerson. On a probably unrelated note, Mr. Brunt is in an unusually poor mood this evening."
"Out of chewing gum," rumbled Brunt, petting his ox.
"And not confectioner for miles," lamented Mr. Flynn. "Ah, well, where did you say you were going again, Mr. Ingerson?"
"I didn't."
"I'm sure I misheard you."
"Do you think you scare me, Tinderkin?" Gorm asked. "Do you really think it was ye and an ogre made me join this outfit? You had the full force of the law behind you then, remember? Contractually obligated death? Ain't that way anymore. The law is on my side."
"Ah, but law is an interesting thing," said Mr. Flynn. "It only works so long as people want it observed. Those regulations nobody wants have a habit of slipping, no? Nobody obeys the old statutes on not selling meat on temple days, you see, because people enjoy steak regardless of how holy a festival is." The Tinderkin removed an apple from his pouch and started carving it with a long dagger. "It brings Shadowkin to mind, no? I mean, you can give a goblin a job, let's say a squire, but just having a job doesn't mean that people want a greenskin around. How loudly would they protest if such a creature was snuffed out?" Gorm's eyes narrowed. "Makes you think," said Mr. Flynn, popping a slice of apple into his mouth. "What's to stop me from going out and just killing a goblin? Can a few papers really protect it?"
"Oh, the law is way more than papers," growled Gorm. "Why, if the law didn't always matter, how could a shopkeeper put out his wares and know they wouldn't be stolen? How could men buy land if there was a chance the deed might not mean a thing? And if the law can't protect a goblin from you, what on earth could protect you from me?"
Mr. Flynn's grin grew wide and genuine. "I imagine that would be Mr. Brunt's job."
"Oh, right."
Gorm had gotten so caught up in defending the goblin that he had forgotten about the ogre behind Flynn. A great hand closed over his shoulders.
"Another day. Another Gilton," rumbled Brunt.
It's remarkably unusual for anyone to be caught unaware by an ogre, as they generally possess all the stealth and cunning of an avalanche. It's remarkably unpleasant as well, Gorm reflected as he was hoisted into the air.
"I'm afraid he tends to be overprotective," said Mr. Flynn. "Do try to remember that when we meet again, and we will meet again. Good day, Mr. Ingerson."
With a flick of Brunt's wrist, Gorm sailed through the air, through the stable door, and through the stable's back wall. He blasted through the old building in a cloud of rotten splinters, and still had plenty of time to think up a witty retort to shout at Flynn before he hit the ground. The wind was knocked from his ribs when he came to a skidding, rolling landing. He probably would have rolled for another house length had he not slammed into the old post where he'd balanced the trinkets for the king in the wood. Gorm opened his eyes, and the curses he planned to holler at the gnome died on his lips. He was staring up into a pair of startled eyes, an ape-like face with gray skin, the complexion of granite, and long, dagger-like teeth stared back down at him. He opened his mouth to shout a warning, but a massive hand closed over him and smothered the cry. In another instant, he was lifted into the air and carried back into the Mirewood.
"What's taking Gorm?" Caitha wondered aloud.
"He's probably seeing to the horses," said Jin.
The heroes sat around one of the tavern's round tables, nursing bad grog and waiting for cold sandwiches.
"How is the bath water coming?"
Laruna asked the innkeeper.
"I've got swamp muck in places I'd forgotten I even had," said Heraldin. "I must smell worse than the goblin."
"Grot?"
"Oh, my Berlinda is working on your bath," the innkeeper told them. "You're welcome to speak to her if you're in a hurry."
"It can wait," said Heraldin.
He turned back to the heroes. "I'm fairly certain half of that man's business model is blaming his wife."
"It's surprisingly effective," said Niln.
Gaist tapped the bard on the shoulder and held up a box with a thrones board.
"Good idea," said Heraldin. "I think it's going to be a long night."
So they settled in. Heraldin and Gaist started a game. Jin and Laruna reviewed magical theory. Niln quietly began cross-referencing his book of prophecy with the king's notes on the elven marbles. Caitha watched the door. She wondered where Gorm was, although truthfully she was almost as worried about his return. They had yet to discuss her foolishness in the Mirewood, and she was certain it wouldn't be a pleasant conversation. But it was getting long for him to tarry, and something might have followed them from the swamp. Or someone. She felt a clammy hand on her shoulder.
Thorwaganip!
Caitha smiled at the little goblin. Thanks, she said. If he's not back in a few minutes, we'll go and have a look, shall we?
Have a look,
Gleebeck attempted.
Have a look, Gorm Ingerson!
Caitha smiled. That's right. And in the meantime, we do the best we can.
Bathwagon!
Gleebeck's smile was like that of a puppy, enthusiastic, clueless, and full of needle-like teeth.
Very good, Caitha said.
She pushed her grog aside, along with her worries and daydreams of a gardener.
You know, we really should teach you Imperial.
The Mirewood slipped by in a blur of black and gray, leaving Gorm hopelessly disoriented. His mind raced as he was borne along an unseen path into the swamp. He hadn't had long to look at the face of his captor, but he was fairly certain he was dealing with a troll. Gorm had never faced a troll, but the evidence that he was being carried by one was compelling. The stony complexion and rough texture of the hand pressed over Gorm's mouth, the ragged fur as clumped and bedraggled as swamp lichen, the unnatural speed and silence with which the beast moved through the wood. He recognized many of the traits from Heroes Guild warnings, or from the post-mortem files of lost adventurers. The histories of the Agekeepers said that trolls, like all Shadowkin, were descended from the races of men that had been twisted by Stennish magic. Several ages and countless generations ago, the orcs were once elves, and goblins had been dwarves, and gnolls gremlins, and slaw were all lost clans of gnomes. The trolls, however, weren't just twisted by the magic of the traitorous Sten. They were the last descendants of the Sten themselves. Trolls' solitary nature and aversion to any sort of community meant they were rare, which was fortunate, because if they weren't, everything else would be. Legendarily cruel, unbelievably stealthy, and terrifyingly lethal, trolls were one of only three types of monsters that the guild had no official classification for. Gorm recalled that the troll entry within the Heroes Guild handbook merely showed a woodcut and read, "Flee and pray." They didn't go far before the creature propped Gorm against a tree, as though setting up a doll in a diorama. The troll was like a mountain gorilla, but more mountain than gorilla. The fur covering his stony skin was charcoal with patterns of silver and steel blue, and was covered only by a loincloth and a band of small pouches across the creature's chest. His broad, apish face was reminiscent of a skull, with wide nostrils and small eyes set in deep sockets. An array of twisted, mismatched fangs nearly bisected his face when he bared his teeth. The troll crouched down so low that its face was almost level with the dwarf.
"I think we should have a talk," he said in a deep, grating voice, like granite on a grindstone.
It wasn't much of an opening, but Gorm didn't expect better. He drew his axe and swung it upward in a sudden strike that connected with the troll's throat. He could feel the axe head dig deep into the beast's jugular. Thick, black blood poured out in spurts that matched the troll's choking gasps. Seizing the chance, Gorm abandoned his old weapon and ran, bounding into the darkness as far as his legs would carry him. Which, as it turned out, wasn't far at all. The edge of the clearing was still far from reach when he was grabbed by the leg and hoisted into the air. The troll's face swung into view, upside down and decidedly unhappy. Gorm braced himself for the end. The troll reached up and, with pointed slowness, pulled the axe from his neck and offered it to Gorm. Gorm took the axe.
"Aha! Yes, well, I was wondering where I'd misplaced that. Careless, really." "Indeed," managed the troll, his voice cracking as his vocal cords knit themselves back together. The wound in his neck had almost totally closed already. "And now you and I are going to have a talk."
"Right," said Gorm. He launched a storm of axe blows that slashed across the troll's face and arm, kicked his way free, and almost made it three steps before he was hauled into the air once more.
"Rrr! Why do you keep doing that?"
the troll growled, once enough of his face had regrown.
"Pretty foolish of me,"
Gorm admitted.
Can I trust you if I give your weapon back?
Aye.
Good.
The troll handed Gorm his axe. But you shouldn't, said Gorm, slamming the axe into the troll's eye. Theoretically, Gorm reasoned, if he could blind the beast, he might buy enough time to get into the swamp. It was, like many good theories, completely wrong.
I suppose an abduction makes a poor start to building a foundation of trust, said the troll a few moments later.
Probably, agreed Gorm.
Then again, sticking an axe in someone's face doesn't help the situation much, does it?
Nor does pinning someone upside down to a tree, said Gorm.
The blood was rushing to his head.
Therein lies our problem. How can I be sure you won't run again if I put you down?
Don't know, said Gorm. He was starting to feel dizzy. How do I know you won't kill me if I don't run?
Master Dwarf, I can assure you that when I want to kill someone, they are well aware of it, though only for a very short period of time.
The troll twisted his wrist to right Gorm.
Fair enough. Then what do you want?
I think I've been perfectly clear, said the troll, furrowing his brow. I want to talk, to parley, to make a deal. It would also be nice to not get stabbed or hacked in the face while doing so, if that's not too much trouble.
From what I hear, trolls don't negotiate,
and flying dwarves don't burst through walls. But here we are, said the troll, setting Gorm on the ground. All I want is to talk.
You dragged me from the inn all the way to the middle of the Mirewood just to talk?
Look, I'll acknowledge this wasn't terribly well thought out.
The troll paused, struggling to find words.
It's just that if you had screamed, she might have heard, anyone might have heard. It's very difficult to explain.
I can see that.
How about you take some time to think it over, said Gorm. A few years would be ideal.
And I'll just head back to my friends at the inn.
No!
Shouted the troll, and the trees shook with the force of his emphasis. Gorm froze.
No, Look, sorry about that. Let's start over. My name is Thane,
he said, extending a finger.
Gorm Ingerson?
He shook the troll's finger as if it were a hand.
Excellent. Mr. Ingerson, I noticed earlier that you have a goblin with you.
Aye, said Gorm slowly. He's me squire.
Ah, so you must be the same Gorm Ingerson who punched out the elven guard at
Bloody Bones. Has anybody not heard about that?
Gorm was almost starting to regret giving the guard his comeuppance. A hero trying to revitalize his career needed to pay at least a little heed to his reputation, and at the rate things were going, Gorm's outburst at the embassy would probably be the talk of the Festival of Orchids. The troll bared his fangs again, and what Gorm realized was actually a grotesque facsimile of a smile.
So, you're at least somewhat receptive to the idea of working with Shadowkin.
Some. Shadowkin, Gorm qualified, did you bring me out here to ask for a job?
Technically, I was out there to collect payment, said the troll.
He reached into one of his pouches and held out a handful of trinkets and beads. Gorm recognized the purple payment he'd left atop a post behind the stables.
You're the king in the wood.
Well, it's a bit much as titles go, said the troll,
with what could have been a hint of false modesty. It was hard to read the expression on a troll's face. Mostly they just looked murderous.
So you followed us all the way back from the thug's camp, said Gorm.
Right.
And the swamp beasts stayed away because...
Exactly. Everything avoids me,
beamed Thane.
It's natural instinct, and monsters and threats could avoid all of you, too. If I was traveling as your squire...
Slow down, it ain't so simple, said Gorm. People see goblins in town all the time, but a troll's a different thing. There ain't any troll NPCs. Imagine what unsuspecting folks would think if they saw you walking us down the street, to say nothing of what they'd think of the dwarf walking next to you.
If he brought a troll back, Gorm wouldn't have to worry about attending the Festival of Orchids anymore. The clan would reinstate him, just so they could banish him again.
I'm well aware of people's reactions, thank you, said the troll,
looking annoyed, or perhaps hurt.
But look!
He bounded back into the clearing and crouched low. His muscles and skin tensed and shifted. Some hairs retracted, and others shifted into mossy patterns. Earthy patterns flickered over his skin. In less than a second, the troll was indistinguishable from a mossy pile of granite boulders.
Pardon me,
swore Gorm softly.
See, said the troll, shifting from mineral to monster as he sprang to his feet. They'll never see me.
Maybe not a passerby, but what will I tell me party, said Gorm.
Nothing, said Thane. You don't tell them a thing. It's our secret.
I'd have to tell them, said Gorm.
No, said the troll. That's the deal. I protect you, and you can't... You don't tell her about me. That's all I want.
Who?
Her name is Caitha, said the troll.
Why would you...
Oh, no. There was no mistaking the enamored glint in the troll's beady eyes.
She came into my garden, said the troll, looking wistfully into the distance. She spoke to me.
Nope, nope, said Gorm, staring at his feet. Dwarves are reticent about almost any matters of the heart, but Gorm imagined most non-dwarves would be equally uncomfortable at the thought of a troll besotted with an elf.
This ain't my business. We talked of life and dreams, of what we were and are and could be. And she sang to me, Mr. Ingerson.
You don't have to tell me about it.
Images were springing up in Gorm's mind, and he couldn't stamp them out fast enough.
She sang a song so sweet that animals came into my garden. They weren't even scared.
It's just that it ain't proper to speak of such things.
And her song, like the voice of a goddess. It's like I've lived my whole life just to hear that voice.
So, go and tell her that, said Gorm. Or don't, so long as you leave me out of it.
Tell her?
Thane looked at Gorm incredulously.
Aye, you talked, right? Just say hello, or whatever it is you tall folk do when you're fond of each other.
Well, yes, but to her, I was a spirit of the forest, a force of nature. If I just go and talk to her, I'd just be this.
The troll gestured helplessly at himself.
This is what makes people who see me run screaming, or try to put an axe through my face. What if she did that?
He shuddered visibly at the thought.
I couldn't endure it. Not from her.
Sorry, said Gorm, but I've a job to do, and I don't need some tragic, unrequited love interfering with it.
While the Heroes Guild handbook couldn't forbid anything, it recommended against any sort of romantic involvement on the job. To a professional hero, any sort of distraction could be deadly, for the lovers and others. So the guild frowned on budding romances, passionate interludes, or even unseen pining. While the guild wasn't specific on fraternizing with trolls or other monsters, Gorm was confident it would be universally frowned upon. The only thing more distracting than an interspecies relationship among the party would be the inevitable torch-waving mobs that came to end the abomination.
I'm not asking you to get involved, pleaded the troll. I'm asking for the exact opposite. Keep my secret. Let me stay by her side, as she'd prefer me. As the faceless king.
Gorm shook his head. It's just... You don't keep a secret this big from your party.
Thane seemed to wither like a flower in frost.
I see, he said. I suppose it's for the best. If I can't sway the dwarf who defended a goblin, what hope could I have with her?
Gorm let out a long, weary sigh and tried to convince himself that fame and fortune and the Festival of Orchids were all overrated.
You won't regret this, said Thane.
I regretted it the moment I agreed to it, said Gorm, allowing the troll to gently set him down a few yards behind the tavern.
You won't regret this any more than you already do.
I've said as much about a lot recently, and I'm always wrong.
An autumn evening was falling on the Red Sow, and Gorm could see concerned figures peering through the glowing amber windows. Soon the heroes would send out searches.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got to run to the stables.
The stables?
Aye, a piece of straw or two in me beard and some muck on me boots, and everyone will think I spent too long grooming the horses.
Bidding farewell to Thane was more involved than he expected, as the troll required several reassurances that his secret was safe. After several grumbled promises, Gorm managed to extricate himself and start for the stables. He glanced back over his shoulder when he had crossed half the distance. The ruins of Ebonmire were empty, save for a pile of boulders that briefly flashed him a thumbs up. Gorm's explanation of his prolonged absence, which included his encounter with Flynn and Brunt and his trip to the stables, but omitted any reference to the troll encounter, was to everyone's satisfaction, save the innkeeper and Niln. The innkeeper was unhappy about the hole in his stables. Niln was unhappy that he had to pay for it. There was just one piece of unfinished business left for the evening. Gorm held off until after he'd laid the case for going to Bloodroot, after Niln and the others had reluctantly agreed, after the food had been served and eaten and complained about, and after the other heroes had grown weary, one by one, and headed upstairs to bed. It wasn't until he and Caitha were the only two left at the table that he started the conversation they'd both been dreading.
"You split the party, Caitha."
The elf wilted a little.
"I know."
"You never split the party."
"I know.
You had me chewing my whiskers with worry. If you'd fallen out there, or gotten lost, what could we do? You might have died. You might not have been the only one."
"I know."
It hadn't been the only time she'd slipped, Gorm told her, but she knew that as well. Her late-night drinking binges were making them depart late and compromising combat readiness. She knew that, too. People were starting to think she was in the midst of another of her famous meltdowns, and to worry they would soon be at the center of another story for the more salacious town criers. Caitha was well aware. The unspoken issue sitting between them wasn't that Caitha didn't know she was in another spiral, but that she didn't know any way out, except the spot at the bottom. Gorm sighed.
"So, why did you split the party?"
I needed a drink," said the elf reluctantly.
"Right in the middle of the swamp.
I think we've made it clear that I have a problem."
"So how do we fix it?" said Gorm.
"Here."
Caitha pushed her grog away. She rummaged through her rucksack, produced a silver flask, and dropped it on the table.
"I'll have no more drink. Not another drop."
"You think it's that simple?"
Caitha shook her head.
"Gorm, when I was in the wood, I felt like something followed me, keeping me safe, a protector. And when it was there, I wasn't so thirsty."
She looked out the window wistfully, and Gorm felt a chill run up his spine. The ranger was looking directly at the spot where he had left Thane.
"And I know he likely isn't there, that this king in the wood is probably a superstition wrapped in a marketing ploy, but thinking he is there, that he might really be watching over me, it helps, you know. I don't want to drink as much. I'm more myself. The me I used to be when I was the Jade Wind."
She turned back to Gorm.
"It's a useful lie, so I believe it. It's better than reality. Like telling yourself there's justice in the world, or that we can make a difference. They're probably not true, but we'll be better people if we pretend they are. I don't know if I can fix everything about myself by giving up drinking and handing you the flask, or even fix anything, but I'll come closer if I trust it will work. So what choice do I have but to believe? We need the lie."
Gorm looked out the window and saw the silhouette of a pile of boulders that was not a pile of boulders.
"Aye,"
was all he could say. Caitha followed his gaze.
"I still dream that the king in the wood is more than a spirit, and perhaps even a man, an elf, and that he made the garden I found in the Mirewood, and I could join him there again some day, after all of this."
"It's possible,"
Gorm lied. His heart was heavy as he bade her good night.